Politics Uncensored with Ali Milani on FUBAR Radio.
Hello everybody, it's Ali Milani on FUBAR Radio with another edition of Politics Uncensored. We're talking general election today after the expected results tonight of the Mid-Bedfordshire by-election, the Tamworth by-election. We've got a couple more by-elections likely around the corner, including Blackpool South and another one in Wellingborough. We've already had Uxbridge and South Ruislip. We've had 101 by-elections. We might as well have a damn general election at this point. But one of the things we want to talk about is how this system works. We have many people in the country who assume our politics, I think, are similar to that of the United States, where we have a fixed election periods, who might not know who gets to call a general election. And we want to speculate a little bit today about when that general election might come and what the context around that is, what are the chances that Sunak and the Conservatives have, what are the chances that Starmer and the Labour Party have, and the Liberal Democrats are always there for a stunt to, like, kick over some wall or something like that, which they love to do. But before we get into the details of the general election and when it might come, we have a returning guest, Councillor Nabila Moulana, Labour councillor in Sheffield and chair of Young Labour. Nabila, how are you?
Good, thank you, Ali. Thank you for having me on the programme.
Thank you so much for joining us again. Like I said, we're talking about elections today, so I'm going to come to that soon. But before we get into that, I want to ask you about Peter Bone, who has today been stripped of the Conservative Party whip after the MP was found to have bullied and harassed a member of staff and exposed his genitals near their face. The chief whip, Simon Hart, made the decision the day after a parliamentary watchdog recommending Bone be suspended from the Commons for 6 weeks, paving the way for a possible by-election. Bone has denied all the allegations, we should say, and vowed to continue representing his constituency in Wellingborough in Northamptonshire. There is a serious cultural problem in Westminster, is there not? Because we keep hearing about sexual harassment and abuse cases, inappropriate conduct, MPs consistently under investigation, having to leave Parliament. Is our politics really as dirty as it looks from the outside?
I think it's really hard to look at the way politics has taken shape over the last, I don't know, however many years, and to conclude that actually, you know, Westminster's fine, everything's going as it should do, these are the people who are right to represent this country. I think it's incredibly concerning to see the, I suppose, culture that people speak about, speak of in mm-hmm. Westminster, that seems to exist. And, you know, I remember, I think it was a Labour MP who tweeted that when she first got elected to Parliament, you know, she was a young woman who just, you know, got into Parliament, and she was told which members of Parliament she shouldn't ever be alone in a room with. And, you know, it's clear that this is an open secret where parliamentarians know which of their colleagues.
So she had been advised that there are. So she'd been advised that, I mean, the assumption is that she'd been advised that there are members of Parliament who she might not be safe around alone in a room.
Absolutely. And that she should avoid and, you know, shouldn't be alone with. And I think this is terrifying where we're sending people into Parliament where we know that there are other people who clearly aren't fit to be in there.
And clearly a culture really and a culture in Parliament where people know it's happening and are either mm-hmm. covering it up or not talking about it, not raising it. And these people are allowed to walk around on the state, represent people and make others feel more unsafe.
No, absolutely. And I do think it's incredibly disappointing to see mm-hmm. From whichever party, really.
And I want to ask you a little bit because you're the chair of Young Labour, a councillor in Sheffield, a woman, visibly Muslim woman. How difficult are these spaces for you? Because I've felt it myself, and, you know, Muslim women specifically have some of the hardest times in terms of the accessibility of these spaces, the safeness of these spaces, and whether, you know, their participation. Can you talk to us a little bit about, you know, just being a visibly Muslim woman in politics and how difficult that is given the system and the things we're reading about?
Absolutely. I mean, I do, again, think it's, an open secret of, I suppose, the difficulties that Muslim women face in politics, in any political space. I think Apsana Begum is actually a very good example of just how difficult it can be to be a Muslim woman in politics, visibly Muslim, but also I think a Muslim woman with very left-leaning politics, which, you know, we've seen the treatment of Afsana from all across the political class. And I think it's incredibly hard for me to sit here and tell other young people, especially other young Muslim women, you know, you should aspire to engage in politics and you should aspire to engage in political life, whether that's in parliament or in other spaces, because quite frankly, you feel like you're pushing them to invest time and energy and, you know, a lot of emotion into spaces that really don't want them there or want them there in a very limited capacity.
Yeah, or just throw abuse at them. I mean, you mentioned the Afsana Begum case, I think, or Afsana Begum's experience, the MP for Poplar and Limehouse, first hijab-wearing MP in Parliament. At Labour Party conference, it was reported only by Navara Media, I think, that she had to leave because she didn't feel safe because of the amount of threats that she was getting.
Absolutely, and I think that's a massive failing, actually.
I mean, what kind of scandal is that no one else reported that other than Navara?
And I think it's because it's almost accepted, right? It's accepted that there are some people who are going to find politics and political spaces more difficult than other people. And it's just accepted as a given that
these spaces aren't for
the
them.
Likes of Sara Sultana and Afsana Begum and, you know, the tens of other, few other Muslim MPs there are. Yeah. Of course they're going to find politics different. Sadly, that's just the nature of the world we live in. Yeah. And I think there's a real lack of accountability from Parliament and from the different political parties of the kind of culture they create and allow.
And an acceptance of it, right? Because I've spoken to, like you said, there's a few Muslim MPs, the likes of Naz Shah, Afzal Khan, Yasmin Qureshi, like you said, Zara, Absana, others. And whether it's Muslim MPs or councillors, particularly women as well, or women MPs as well, I've dealt with the Labour Women's Network as well and the amazing work that they do. There's just an acceptance that, well, this is how it is, and you've got to either be a really tough woman to get through it, or politics isn't for you. That's got to be some sort of, like, that's really tough to take. Because then if a young person comes and asks you, as the chair of Young Labour, a young woman, a woman, or a Muslim woman, or a Muslim in general, is politics worth it? Can you say yes?
I think I have actually had young women come up to me and ask me, really excitedly saying, oh, you're a councillor, what's that like? Or, oh, you're involved in all these spaces, what's that like? And I think when I first got elected, I'd, you know, talk to them about how great it is to have more people involved and how the only way we can change it is by being involved. But I think the longer I've sort of carried on being involved in politics, and this isn't to put anyone off who's listening, but I suppose you feel this compulsion to have to be honest.
Yeah.
And even reflecting on my own experiences, I would find it really hard.
Yeah,
to look at a young Muslim and say, yep, completely go for it.
And I had that. I was really scared at the beginning to talk about like the death threats that we got, the abuse that we got, because I didn't want people to be afraid to get involved. And I knew that we needed more people to get involved. But there's an element of it now where I've reached a position of we can't not talk about it, because that's how the culture, that's how the norms are created. That's how it's allowed that woman that you talked about, that MP, was told, don't be alone in a room with this guy and this guy and this guy. That it's that culture of not talking about it that's allowed us to get where we are. And I really do hope you keep fighting, because I'm sure there are lots of young women in the Labour Party that are looking up to you and the amazing work that you do. I'm going to move on to the next story, and that's laughing gas. That's these little canisters that you might have seen on the streets, and they're a drug that's used mainly by young people, but people across the board as well. And the story is that possessing laughing gas will be made illegal in 3 weeks, with those who repeatedly misuse the drug facing up to 2 years in prison. And dealers of nitrous oxide will face up to 14 years behind bars, the Home Office has said. The ban will come into force on November 8th and will make nitrous oxide a controlled Class C drug under the Misuse of Drugs Act 1971. It is one of the most commonly used recreational drugs among young people. It comes after MPs voted overwhelmingly to have it categorised as a Class C drug by 404 votes to 36 last month. Critics have previously warned against a ban, saying it could stop users seeking medical help, but the government says it is clamping down on antisocial behaviour and drug taking in public. I believe the government actually went against the medical advice for once on this, where they were asked about whether this had significant health concerns, and obviously if used in large quantities and frequently, there are health concerns. But the medical advice was that it wasn't of huge concern in terms of its the medical side effects. And the government went against that advice, saying they're taking the antisocial behavior into account. What's your reaction to the banning of laughing gas?
I think, Ali, like, it's clearly something that people feel quite strongly about in terms of, like, amongst young people. And I think it's part of a wider conversation about the government's attitude to recreational drugs, but also their attitude towards antisocial behaviour and young people in general. Whereas if we were to, you know, if their main focus was antisocial behaviour, if they were worried about young people and the, you know, the things they get up to, essentially, I think the government would have invested more in young people and in the spaces that engage young people in other sort of activities. And what we have seen from this government for the last 13 years, consistently, starting straight from David Cameron, is cuts after cuts after cuts in the regions of millions of pounds to youth services. You know, we completely decimated youth services in the billions. We funneled it all into one specific program called National Citizen Service. And that was more or less the end of it. Mm-hmm. And we've seen the impact this has had over 13 years. My own youth club turned into a food bank. And I think actually that was one of the biggest drivers for me to get into politics. But what we have seen in, you know, the area like mine, which I represent, it's one of the poorest. It's actually the most deprived ward in the city. And young people are desperate for some kind of provision. And instead, we're having to, you know, instead of having a properly funded youth service, instead of having properly funded interventions, public health support, public health information, what we have instead is services trying their absolute most to deliver something for young people whilst the government is constantly showing them the door every time they ask for support. So yeah, I think this has to be looked at in, I suppose, a much wider landscape of government cuts.
Yeah, it also feels like Westminster politics, and not just Conservatives, but Westminster politics in general, just has one knee-jerk reaction to drug policy, and that's ban it and police it. And that hasn't worked for 20 years. I don't know why they think it'll work in the next 20 years. But are they just out of ideas on how to deal with drugs? Because the sort of the quote-unquote war on drugs in America didn't work. The illegalization and policing of drugs as a singular tactic clearly has not worked in the UK. Do they just have no other ideas on how to deal with it, or is it just looking tough to the public in an election year?
I do think it's a bit of both. I think we see, particularly in run-up to elections, where political parties tend to have very knee-jerk responses to events. But I do also think that what we have seen consistently, and sometimes from, you know, across the benches, is a real lack of ideas. And I suppose a lack of political will and courage to talk about something differently, to try out something new, even when the lines are peddling, you know, there's years and years of evidence that it's failed. So I do think it's a lack of political courage, actually, which is a shame when considering the multiple crises we're currently facing.
Yeah, and we'll come on to the final story, and that's the theme of today's show, which is voting and elections. So voting has opened in Mid-Bedfordshire and Tamworth by-elections, the by-elections which will decide who replaces Nadine Dorris in Mid-Bedfordshire, who stood down in August, and Chris Pincher in Tamworth, who stood down in September. Nabila, let's have a bit of fun. One word to describe Nadine Dorris. Keep it PG. Actually, you don't have to keep it PG. We're on uncensored here.
Awful.
I would have gone with idiot, but I'm not going to make you do Chris Pincher. There are 13 candidates on the ballot paper in Mid-Bedfordshire and 9 in Tamworth. Tamworth's by-election will see a battle between the Conservatives and Labour. Labour held the Staffordshire seat. I haven't been drinking, I promise. Labour held the Staffordshire seat between 1997 and 2010 when Pincher was first elected. Mid-Bedfordshire has been controlled by the Tories since 1931. Nadine Dorris won the seat 5 times since being elected in 2005. At the last election, Miss Dorris won with a majority of 24,000. Obviously, these are two fairly safe Conservative seats. If Labour were to win this, it's a massive, massive signal as to what's coming in the general election.
Absolutely, and I think, you know, there is a real hope amongst Labour supporters that Labour will be able to make two gains tonight. You know, we've seen even in Rutherglen and Hamilton West with Michael Shanks, you know, winning back a seat that was previously held by Labour but has been held by the SNP for the last few years. And there does seem to be, I suppose, a lot of will from the public to give Labour a chance after 13 years of the Tories making an absolute mess of it. So,
I mean,
hope as the Labour Party will be making to Gains tonight.
Well, when I think one of the things that we're going to be speaking about later is just the amount of by-elections we've had recently. I mean, we've got Mid-Bedfordshire now, Tamworth. We'll have probably Blackpool South up for by-election as well. Maybe Wellingborough as well. We had Uxbridge and South as well as other places. Surely the time is now to just call a general election, get it over with. I mean, we're almost doing a general election every, like, a year-long general election now. Where do you think people are, particularly young people, in their sort of will for a general election?
I think any sort of polling has shown that young people who vote are likely to vote Labour. You know, 13 years of Tory government has done absolutely nothing for them, actually. And any issue that we had in 2010 has only been worsened. And so I suppose I'm confident that young people who turn up to the ballot box will be voting for more progressive parties, whether that's Labour or whether that's any other party who they consider to be progressive that aren't the Tories.
And that's the sense you're getting from young people.
For a general election sooner rather than later, but I suppose only time will tell.
Well, unfortunately, John Rentoul in The Independent thinks that it could go on until January 2025. And the fun fact I'm being told is that there have been 16 by-elections held in the current parliament, which might be a record. It's felt like 116. But, you know, whether it's January 2025, whether it's May 2024 or autumn 2024, we know one is coming and the Conservatives are in big, big trouble. Thank you once again. That was Councillor Nabila Moulana, Labour Councillor in Sheffield and Chair of Young Labour. Thank you so much for coming back and speaking to us about the headlines in this week's Unwrapped. Like I said, today's show is centred around an article that we saw by John Rentoul, who will be joining us later on in the show, where he has written Vote Labour on Thursday and Get a General Election in January 2025. And that got a conversation going here at FUBAR about, you know, when can general elections be held? How long does it take? What are the rules around it? How come the Conservatives can just call it whenever they like, or Rishi call it whenever they like? And that's what we're going to talk about today. We'll be speaking to Tim Bale, Professor of Politics at Queen Mary, in a moment. And then we'll have John Rentoul later on from The Independent talking about his article. But knowing that the last general election was in December 2019, the conversation that we were having here was, when is it likely to be? It's a little bit strange, I think, for people, because they're used to sort of an American politics system or European politics where it's a set point of time. And so that's what we're going to get into with Professor of Politics at Queen Mary, Tim Bale. I spoke to him earlier today, and he was really, really interesting in unpacking what the rules are, what the constitutional rules are, what the statutory rules are. So do pay attention to what he's saying. Another fun fact in this interview, obviously we spoke earlier today, and my producers tried to kill me during this interview and roast me in the studio rather than turning the AC on, the heater was turned on. So if you listen carefully, about 3 minutes into the interview, you might realize that I think I'm having a stroke, only about 10 minutes later to figure out that the AC has been put on hot or something, and I'm dying in the interview. Nonetheless, an amazingly interesting interview with Tim from Queen Mary. You'll hear from him after this.
FUBAR Radio presents
Access All Areas.
We have the absolute icon, legend, Janice Dickinson.
I'm here.
Do you still enjoy doing reality shows, or do you now see it as more of like a part of your job that you like have to do?
I do really enjoy it. I don't enjoy the actuality of eating fish eyeballs.
Well, yeah, there's that side to Amazon.
Or vagina of cow.
Yeah. But you do like the sort of social side, do you? Like just the
social side was fantastic. Just getting to know people and sleeping with people and eating with people when we didn't really have enough food.
This week we have Natalie Balmain, winner of Channel 4's Make Me a Prime Minister. We do have a serious problem with the standard of our public servants and the behaviour they display both in office and in ministerial office, no?
Absolutely, 100%. We're an embarrassment.
Yeah.
You know, we're a nation that once purported to be world leaders. But now with the people we have in charge, we can't even lead ourselves.
Well, we are leading the world in terms of idiots and clowns in office, I think.
Do you remember back in the day when it used to be like fashionable, or it was the thing to do when you go on Facebook. Yeah, and you'd be like, oh, I'm like in a relationship. What was the other one? It was it's complicated. Do you remember that one?
Yeah, it's in a relationship with.
Yeah.
Or it's complicated. But then what it used to do, it used to pop up on the feed. So you'd be sitting there.
Yeah.
And then in your feed, it would be, I don't know, Jess, whoever is now single. So you like that one. Or poke them. Did you poke them? And then you'd give them a little poke.
Yeah. Yeah.
Give a little virtual poke.
Yeah.
Just to go, I see you're single now, babe.
Yeah.
Facebook were great, wasn't it?
You're listening to Foodbar Radio.
Foodbar Radio.
Foodbar Radio.
Foodbar Radio.
Foodbar Radio. Foodbar Radio.
Okay, as we have two more by-elections in Mid-Bedfordshire and Tamworth coming up today, with everyone's favourite MP, Nadine Dorris, and everyone's not-so-favourite MP, Chris Pincher, seeing the final door, we are talking about general elections. How do they work? When can we call one? When, for God's sake, can we stop having by-elections and have a full-on-fledged general election? And joining me to talk about just that is Tim Bale, Professor of Politics at Queen Mary University. Tim, thank you so much for joining us. Please enlighten us. When are we going to get a damn general election?
I think probably the most likely date is going to be the autumn of 2024, probably October or November. Rishi Sunak could, if he wanted to, go right the way through to January 2025, believe it or not. And some people have speculated on May next year, but I think autumn is the most likely date.
And so one of the questions I think folks will have is they'll be used to democracy and elections kind of like what they see in America and in other countries, where there's a fixed point in time, you get 4 years or 5 years, depending on what country you're in, and you know that November, for example, next year is going to be US election time. How do general elections work in this country, and how come we don't know when they might be?
Well, we used to, actually, up until a couple of years ago, they had to be held every 5 years, although actually what happened was that Parliament found a way of getting around that and calling elections early. Before that, and it's the case now as well, because that legislation has been repealed, prime ministers essentially have the say over when to call an election. All they need to do is get the agreement of their cabinet to call an election and go to the king now, and the king will allow them to dissolve parliament and they can have an election. There is a maximum, however, of around 5 years. So that's why, in the end, Rishi Sunak will have to go in January 2025, even if he doesn't necessarily want to.
And so how does that work? Say, so it's entirely up to the ruling party, up to a maximum, like you said. Does there have to be a vote in Parliament, or does the cabinet just agree it and then that's it?
No, the cabinet just has to agree it, really. And to be honest, even the cabinet very rarely has that much say in it. It's normally really very much up to the prime minister and his or her closest advisers. The cabinet are normally told. I guess they could revolt, if you like, and say, no, you're not going to do that, and then depose the prime minister. But actually, that never seems to have happened. It's really up to the prime minister.
So from a sort of technical legal point, is it the king that actually calls a general election on the advice of the prime minister? Is that
yes,
how it works?
Yes, I mean, technically that's the case. It's the king that gives permission to the prime minister to dissolve parliament and to hold a general election. So yes, in the end, I guess it is up to the monarch. But there's no precedent in modern times anyway for the monarch refusing a dissolution. I mean, technically it might be possible if he thought that the prime minister was trying to pull a fast one in some way, but it'd be very, very unlikely.
Or if the prime minister was just off their head and unsuitable for office. But we did have Boris Johnson. I'm not gonna make you answer that question. So you mentioned that there's limits, the 5 year limit. Where does that come from? Because I mean technically the 5 year limit ends next year, not in 2025.
Well, I mean, that is simply because it's I think 5 years and sort of 1 or so months. It really depends on when the election is actually called, because then you have a certain period of time between the election being called and the election being held. And that's why it can go into January. Actually, historically, it used to be 7 years, but for the greater part, really, of the 20th century anyway, it's been 5 years. Mm-hmm. And that's just really been the
And convention. Is that statutory? Is that set in law? Or is that a sort of understood thing that the king will intervene after 5 years?
Well, I mean, so much of our constitution is not necessarily laid down in statute, but the 5 years plus however long it takes to hold the campaign is essentially a legal requirement, yes.
When you say essentially, I mean, just because we've seen so many precedents broken and we've had a really wild 10 years in British politics, I'm just trying to see if there's a slither of a chance where it doesn't even happen in 2025.
There's no way that Rishi Sunak could delay it beyond January 2025. I can guarantee that.
Mm-hmm. And so we're talking to John Rentoul later today, and he's written an article where he is stating that if Labour were to win tonight, that we might see the Conservatives hold on as long as they can, given, you know, they will know that they're on borrowed time and that might push to 2025. What's your view on that?
Yes, I mean, I think, you know, obviously, if they were to suffer a setback of losing both of the by-elections, that is going to put any idea that some Conservatives might have of going early into the bin, as it were. I think it's, you know, unlikely anyway that they would want to go early. I mean, the precedent is that prime ministers hold on for as long as they possibly can, really, hoping that something will turn up if they are in, you know, a position of being behind in the polls, as Rishi Sunak is right now. I mean, I think the real question is whether he would want to go all the way to January 2025 or whether he would want to at least preserve some freedom of manoeuvre and some illusion, if you like, that he's in control by holding the election in October or November. I mean, the problem with January, of course, is that A, the campaign would stretch across Christmas, which probably wouldn't do any government any favours. We've already had Christmas cancelled by COVID on a couple of occasions. I'm not sure people would want it effectively spoiled for them by a general election. And if you see it from the point of view of the parties, I think that, you know, they would regard that Christmas week as being a kind of lost week as far as campaigning was concerned and really wouldn't want to give up that time. So I suspect that that plus the fact that I guess, you know, going all the way to January 2025 would make it very obvious that the government was just hanging on and hanging on and hanging on means that they are likely to go in the autumn.
Yeah, and the rumours in Westminster, I mean, I for my sins, was in Westminster recently and met, again, for my sins, parliamentarians. And the consensus seemed to be that they thought it would be May 2024, largely because the Conservatives won't want to be hammered in a local election, which often happens to the party of government, and then go back to the country a couple of months later, that the recovery time will be next to nil. What's your view on that sort of theory that's hanging around in Parliament?
Well, I mean, I think governments very rarely cut their losses, if you like. I mean, I think, you know, it is normal for governments just to hang on as long as they possibly can, hoping, as I say, that something will turn up. I mean, you could argue that, you know, were they a kind of rational poker player, if you like, then they would cut their losses and go early and hope perhaps to stem those losses and avoid, as you say, a drubbing in the local elections. But as you know, I mean, I don't need to tell you, politicians are eternally optimistic and sometimes to the point of delusional. Yeah. And, you know, many Conservatives, even though I suspect in their heart of hearts, they probably think it's all over now.
I mean, you don't have to tell me about the delusions of politicians. Someone in this studio once thought he was going to beat a prime minister.
Exactly.
That didn't happen.
Yeah. I mean, I think some Conservatives still harbour the hope that you know, the Labour vote is soft. Keir Starmer isn't that popular. The economy will come right. They'll be able to show that they're stopping the boats. Waiting lists will go down. And, you know, Bob's your uncle. You know, they might just pull it off.
And what's your view on that? Do you think there is a chance of Tory recovery?
Well, I mean, there's always a chance, but I think the fundamentals are against them. I mean, if we look at, for example, the economy, I mean, it's growing very slowly. Real wages are just about rising now, but not by very much. People aren't better off now than they were, you know, 4 or 5 years ago. If you look at the state of the health service, it appears, you know, to be falling apart in some places. And certainly people, for example, are finding it very difficult to get a GP appointment. Waiting times are very long in A&E. Waiting lists generally for elective surgery are very long. And then if you look at perceptions of leaders, You know, Rishi Sunak is down at the kind of levels that Boris Johnson was before he was forced out, and that's with all the all the scandals of Partygate. So, if you put the economy, the state of the NHS, people's views of leaders together, I don't think they bode very well for the Conservatives. But they have got some advantages, right? I mean, they've got a lot of the print media, of course, is still very much pro-Tory. And although fewer and fewer people actually read those newspapers, albeit, you know, some people read them online, they do influence broadcasters' agendas. So, you know, that might help a little bit. They've also got, I guess, you know, the sort of anti-woke green crap type appeals, which, you know, may mobilise their base a little bit. So that goes for them. And then there's that kind of household economy meme, by which I mean, you know, people thinking that the nation's finances are like those of a household, and therefore, you know, we shouldn't spend too much, we shouldn't borrow too much. And that might mean that voters forgive the Conservatives for not actually, you know, turning on the taps as far as tax cuts or indeed, you know, spending.
That economy compared to household expenditures and spending often reminds me of an old Aaron Sorkin quote, where in one of his pieces he says, if you compare you balancing your budget at home to the government balancing their budget in for them, Washington, it's like comparing driving to the supermarket to landing on the moon. And I think that's a really, really good example that often comes to my mind. So I guess the other question I have that you know, listeners might not be fully aware of, and that's part of what we try and do in this segment, is to kind of unravel some of the myths and the parts of our politics that folks might not know. And that's the electoral math and the way that our system works, the first-past-the-post system. That could possibly benefit the Conservatives, could it not? Because you could end up with 44% of the national vote, but because of a first-past-the-post system where you need a certain number of MPs to win a majority, we might have a hung parliament, we might have a Slither Labour majority, or the Tories might hang on.
No, that's quite right. I mean, you know, another thing that favours the Conservatives is, generally speaking, the electoral system. You know, we have to remember that Labour got very badly beaten in 2019, and it needs a huge increase in its vote and the Conservatives' vote to go down quite a lot in order to actually get a one-seat majority. As far as the workings of the first-past-the-post system are concerned, I mean, the Conservatives are at an advantage because their vote is, if you like, more efficiently spread. So they've got more voters in, if you like, the smaller towns, which, you know, make up, you know, quite a lot of constituencies in Parliament, whereas Labour's vote tends to pile up in, you know, bigger cities and therefore, to some extent, is, quote-unquote, wasted. So Labour really does need to improve its vote in those smaller towns, not necessarily so much the rural areas, but, you know, some of the suburbs as well, in order to be able to turn things around. And Labour needs to win quite a lot of seats back in the Midlands and the North in order to enable it to do that.
And Scotland.
Also, usefully, could win some seats in Scotland. And if it can win sort of 20, 25 seats in Scotland, that will make a big difference, I think, to Labour's chances of actually forming a majority government.
And I think Labour will be will have a bounce after the Scottish by-election victory as well. And they'll think that they can do that in Scotland. But I think it's important for folks to know that, you know, you might see Labour with a 20-point lead in it nationally, but it is places like Bedfordshire where they need to make ground. And you know, they are trying to pull back from a defeat in 2019.
Yes, in particular those so-called red wall seats that the Conservatives won in the North and the Midlands in 2019. If Labour can flip some of those back, you know, it will be a big advantage. But, I mean, generally speaking, elections are won and lost in this country, you know, in the Midlands very often, the West Midlands and the East Midlands. And that's where, you know, we need to look, I guess, on election night. If Labour are flipping some of those seats, I think it will be a lot easier. I mean, the Conservatives, I think, you know, if they're as far behind on polling day as they are now, they've absolutely no chance of bringing.
And before I let you go, I just want to ask you about the boundary changes as well, because there was a boundary review. If you could quickly tell folks what that is and what impact that might have.
Yes, I mean, in contrast to the United States, where actually the political parties have a lot of say in how the districts are carved up. In Britain, we have an independent boundary commission that reports every so often and tries to effectively equalise the number of people in each constituency at around 70-odd thousand. It doesn't work exactly, but, you know, they do their best. And that takes account of population movements over time. So, for example, you know, movement out of cities might mean that the city seats are now, you know, smaller than they should be. So sometimes they're amalgamated. Some of the more suburban seats might need to be split in two, for example, to create another seat. But that is a totally independent process. The parties can make appeals to the Boundary Commission if they feel that something's been unfair. But that does mean on occasion that, you know, MPs representing one seat, which may have been quite safe the previous election, because it's actually been changed by the Boundary Commission, might mean that it's more marginal this time around. And it's been calculated that the changes that have been made between the last election and this election probably give the Conservatives an advantage of about, you know, 6, 7, 10 seats maybe. Mm-hmm. But, you know, and if they're going to get absolutely walloped, as it looks as if they might be, by the Labour Party at the next election, then that isn't going to make enough difference for them.
All right, that was Professor Tim Bale, Professor of Politics at Queen Mary University. Tim, I'm going to have you back on next year and we can see how our guesses have fared. Thank you so much, Tim, for joining us. Coming up next, we've got John Rentoul, Chief Political Commentator for The Independent. His article has sparked my interest in the general election, when it might come, if it's May, if it's autumn, if it is indeed in January 2025. We'll hear from him after the break.
FUBAR Radio presents
All areas. And we are joined now by our lovely guest, James Johnson, celebrity hairdresser. How are you, James?
I'm good. Thanks for having me on.
What was Mel B like then? I used to be a Spice Boy.
The best energy.
Did you sing to her?
I can't sing.
Nor can I, but I still
do. I remember the job got cancelled. I went to wherever she was staying in London, it got cancelled. And whoever she was living with made us Victoria sponge cake. So the job got cancelled, we all sat around a table eating cake. I got in the car among none, and I've just sat with a Spice Girl eating Victoria sponge.
Oh, noshing a bit of Vicky Sponge.
Nick Helm and the Daniel Metcalfe Fan Club.
We are joined in the studio now by professional comedian Brett Goldstein. How are you doing, Brett?
I'm very grateful to be here with you too.
If you could dig someone up and fuck them.
Gene Kelly.
Gene Kelly and Cary Grant, right?
Not Cary, there's not much time. If I could dig up Gene Kelly, I'd say, could we do a dance?
I've got the shovel in my boot.
In this scenario, is he still dead when you dig him up, or does he come out?
Does he come to life? Is he a rotten corpse, or is he?
That's Fan Club.
The dating show. Dating or going on dates when you were like a teenager was always quite fun, though. Do you know what I mean? I remember going on dates to like the cinema. You'd go shopping, like shopping centres, wouldn't you?
I think, if anything, they were maybe this just says about life and where it is. But I used to get really excited, like more excited than I do now. Like the thought of going to meet someone in a park, a boy, it was like, oh my fucking God, what trainers am I going to wear? Are my trainers clean? Am I going to plait my hair? It was like, if the thought that would go through my head just to meet one person, whereas now, you know, you might meet someone on the way home from work and it's like the effort, you're still making an effort, but it's like, yeah, I can fit you in. It's completely different.
You're listening to FUBAR Radio.
FUBAR Radio.
FUBAR Radio.
FUBAR Radio.
FUBAR Radio.
We're back on Politics Uncensored, and this week we are talking about elections, by-elections, general elections. And we've just had Tim Bale, Professor of Politics at Queen Mary University, joining us. And he has explained how these general elections work, how our constitution works. But this all really started based on a article by John Rentoul, who will be joining us in just a minute, in which he titles Vote Labour on Thursday and Get a General Election in January 2025. Now, most commentators and journalists have speculated that the general election will almost certainly either be May next year or autumn next year, and John speculates that it may be as late as 2025, depending on the results of tonight. And the view from that John makes in his article is if Labour have a successful night tonight in Mid-Bedfordshire and in Tamworth, both of whom were seen as safe Labour seats prior to this by-election round, then some Tories might be fearful of holding an election quite so soon, certainly in May, and particularly later on in autumn and may try and hold on for as long as they physically can, which, as Tim explained, would be in January 2025. Now, that comes with it all sorts of concerns. A winter general election is often very, very difficult and hurts turnout. A campaigning period that might go through Christmas would be particularly difficult. And obviously, it would mean that an election is happening at the latest possible time, which would make the Tories look particularly weak. Now, let's bear in mind that to win Mid-Bedfordshire today, Labour would need a 19% swing, which, given the national polls, is not beyond Labour, given that in some polls there's the difference is as high as 20%. The difference between Conservatives and Labour. But the Lib Dems have seen Mid-Bedfordshire as a target, as one of their target seats. They thought they could win it from third place, as they did in Tiverton and Honiton and in North Shropshire. They, as they usually do, make the argument that they're better placed for Conservative voters who may want to be defecting from the Conservatives. The view is it's a little bit less of a jump from Conservative to the Liberal Democrats. Now, they make that argument in almost every by-election I've ever seen. And in some places it's successful, like Tiverton and Honiton and North Shropshire, and other places it's not. Now, the difficulty they have is that in Mid-Bedfordshire, Labour quite cleverly commissioned a poll that showed in the constituency, first Labour being ahead of the Tories, and then most recently being neck and neck at 29%, with the Lib Dems trailing on 22%. And obviously, I don't know if it would be a shock if Labour were to win tonight, but it would certainly be a huge move from the general election. And joining us now on the show is Chief Political Commentator for The Independent, John Rentall, who's written this article. John, thank you so much for joining us. I hope you can hear me okay.
I can.
Your article has sparked the entire theme of our show today. And that's the article of Vote Labour on Thursday and Get a General Election in January 2025. We've just spoken to a professor at politics at Queen Mary University who explained to us why it's possible for the Conservatives to push a general election all the way back to January 2025. But do you want to give folks a little bit around your thinking behind the article and why you think that if Labour were to win tonight, that a general election might be as far away as 2025?
Well, because I mean, I think if Labour, especially if Labour win both both by-elections tonight, that would suggest that the Conservatives are in a very, very deep hole, and that the situation is continuing to get worse for them rather than better. I mean, you know, Rishi Sunak was obviously hoping at the start of this year to start to turn things around, and unfortunately for him, you know, the Conservatives' position in the polls, it stopped getting worse, but it didn't start getting better. Mm-hmm. I mean, Labour has been on average ahead in the national opinion polls by 17 points for a very long time, and it's if anything it's crept up since the party conference season. I mean, Labour had a good conference; it was extremely boring, nothing went wrong. The Conservatives had a bad conference. So if the Conservatives lose these two by-elections, that means it's postponing the chances of starting to turn things around. I mean, there's still a year to go until October, which would be the ideal time for them to have the general election. But if things don't start to pick up soon, then I think, you know, Rishi Sunak might just decide we're going to lose anyway, so I'll be prime minister for as long as I can be, which in law, as you were talking about, is January 2025.
Now, I think it's interesting. You talked about party conference season. I was at Labour Party conference, and it did feel different to me. It felt like a party conference of a party about to go into government. And that's not just the behaviour of the MPs, but it felt like much of industry, much of the lobbying world was behaving as if this is the next party of government. And there's a real palpable sense of that on conference floor, whereas I heard Conservative Party was very downbeat and quiet in response.
Yeah.
And I think we've seen that bump. I thought Keir's speech was the best I've seen him give at a party conference. And so that will have had an effect. We've just lost John, so we're going to try and get him back. But like I was saying, I was at the party conference season and... It definitely did feel different. I mean, Owen Jones did a brilliant video of the Conservative Party conference, where he explores and talks to different people and kind of touches on the theme. And I think what was most striking about his video was the fact of how quiet Conservative Party conference is. John, we've got you back. One of the thing I want
I'm sorry about that.
No, it's okay. One of the thing I wanted to ask you was, obviously, I've talked about party conference and how it felt in Labour. But we shouldn't underestimate how big of a swing it would be if Labour are to win tonight, because these are two safe Conservative seats.
That's right. But if you look at the Labour result in Selby and Ainston, which is a very safe Tory seat in Yorkshire, that was in July. Labour won that on a 24% swing. I mean, that is the second highest swing that Labour has ever achieved against mm-hmm. the Conservatives. I think there was one swing higher. I think it was Dudley West when Tony Blair was opposition leader. But the Selby swing was the second best that Labour's ever done. If that happens again, then they can win Tamworth and Midbeds as well. But I mean, Midbeds is complicated because obviously, if the opposition vote is split, then the Tories can win it by a fluke. But that wouldn't really tell us anything about the popularity of the Tory government.
So, can you give us a sense? I mean, you'll obviously have lots of sources. You'll be talking to lots of Conservatives in Westminster. What's the mood like? Are they just expecting a hammering, or do they think, you know, there's a year to go? We might be able to fight this back.
There's a bit of that. I mean, they are surprisingly cheerful Conservatives around Westminster, and actually even in the party conference, I thought people were. They obviously expect. They think losing is probably the most likely outcome, but they haven't given up yet. Mm-hmm. They think they can still turn it around. But what I was saying in that article was, you know, time is running out for them.
Yeah, and one of the questions that we've had is, and one of the things that I've heard is, it's unlikely for them to go beyond May 2024 because they don't want to get a hammering in a local election and then essentially try to rebuild a campaign from a poor result in a local election in May. Do you think that's possible?
No, I think the chances of them being in a fit state to win a general election by May mm-hmm. are remote now. I mean, I think time is running out. I think October is still their main hope. Mm-hmm. And you know, there is a year to go. The economy could well be improving over the year, and I think the opinion polls will narrow, but they'll be narrowing from a very strong Labour position, and there's a long, long way to go. And I think, you know, there's an awful lot of things that are still going wrong for the Conservatives. I mean, the Peter Bone business, you know, yet another Tory MP having a problem with the standards and ethics. He's been found guilty of bullying a member of staff. You know, that means another by-election. I mean, and the thing is, every time one of these scandals happens, mm-hmm. because of the recall law, not only do the Conservatives suffer the embarrassment of having an MP found guilty of wrongdoing of some kind, they then have to go through a by-election and lose it.
That was going to be one of my questions to you, because you do make that point very well in the article, is that, you know, we've had a bunch of MPs investigated for various different things and then by-elections. We've got the two now. You said Blackpool South and Wellingborough. Could this not be seen as death by a thousand cuts for the Conservatives, just loss after loss after loss?
Well, absolutely. That's my point. I mean, it does begin to feel like that. It feels very much like the mood in of the Conservative government in before the 1997 election, when, you know, the Conservative MPs were falling like ninepins, various financial and sexual scandals, and it felt like a sort of dying mm-hmm. a dying Tory government, and people had gave up on it, and you know, then the economy was doing quite well under John Major, but the Conservative people have just given up on the Conservatives. Mm. I think Rishi Sunak's got a bit more hope, I think, in that people, I think there, you know, there is some popularity there. People do quite like him. They think he's competent.
That was going to be my next question to you, and I'm interested in your thoughts on this, because, I mean, to be honest, Rishi inherited a mess when he came in following Liz Truss. He is outperforming his party in the opinion polls, obviously much further behind to Starmer. What's your sense around around Rishi as a potential campaigner. Obviously, you know, campaigning for leadership when no one else is running against you is one thing. Going to the country against, you know, in a general election is another thing. What's your sense of what we've seen so far, of what we can expect from Rishi, the campaigner? I mean, I know too well how good Boris was, but how will Rishi fare?
Yeah, well, I mean, Rishi Sunak seemed to be quite a good campaigner, I thought, in the Tory leadership election. And, you know, he's very popular as Chancellor, but he seems to have squandered a lot of that. And, you know, as you point out, he was more popular than his party. He still is a bit more popular than his party, but the advantage has been eroded. I mean, the reputational damage done to the Conservative Party is spread to him personally. And so instead of him pulling the Tory party up, the Tory party's pulled him down. And I think that's his problem. And I think in many ways, it's a shame, it's a human tragedy, because I think, you know, Rishi Sunak has done a good job in many ways. Mm-hmm. He's stabilised the ship after the Liz Truss disaster. And yet he's getting no credit for it because people think the Tory party is just a shambles.
And just penultimate question, I've only got a couple more for you. I hope you can stay with us for these. You've mentioned the economy, I think. What needs to change for Rishi to have a chance on polling day? I think, look, the general consensus from Tim, from yourself, from even my view is, if everything goes the way it's going, we're looking at a Labour government. But what needs to change in order for that to change?
Well, I think if the economy bounces back more sharply than expected and people suddenly start to feel better off, I think it could have a different effect from the position in 1997, because then I think there was a real sense that John Major was exhausted, his government was exhausted and worn out, and they were divided on Europe. But if the economy does better than people expect, then I think people aren't going to say, oh, well, we can afford to have a Labour government. People might start to ask themselves, you know, can we afford a Labour government? You know, I'm just starting to feel better off, just starting to get my finances in order. And yet this, you know, this Labour government might come in and impose all sorts of taxes and costs of achieving its climate change ambitions. I think Rishi Sunak's shift on climate change, on net zero, to a more pragmatic stance, as he called it, I think that could pay him dividends if things fall right for him.
Mm-hmm. And then I want to get your thoughts on Keir Starmer. It's Keir is a difficult one, I think, because some of his critics just say he's another Tony Blair. I don't see that. I don't see the comparisons at all, really, with
Tony. He's not very like Tony Blair, is
he? Tony, I thought, was a much better communicator. Now, Keir has led the party technically, I think, quite well, but as a communicator, I think Tony Blair was much better, and therefore better as a campaigner in a general election. What are your senses as it pertains to Sir Keir Starmer?
I think you've put your finger on it there. I think Keir Starmer's not a strong campaigner, and I think Rishi Sunak is. The question is whether people have just given up on Rishi Sunak and decided that he's hopelessly out of touch, rich guy who likes flying around in helicopters. I mean, I do think there's a sort of, we may have passed the point of no return on that. But on the other hand, I think he's a much better communicator than Keir Starmer. Keir Starmer admitted after the Labour leadership election, when he got the job, that he hated campaigning among the party members. I mean, he said it was because he didn't like going against, you know, other Labour. Other Labour colleagues. But I mean, actually, you just get a sense from him that, you know, he's not happy on the campaign trail. He's not happy.
It's not where he feels most comfortable.
With people shaking hands and sort of kissing babies and all the rest of it. Whereas actually, I think Rishi Sunak rather enjoys all that. And I think that will be fascinating to watch in the election campaign.
Keir has improved, though. I what did you think of his conference speech? Because I thought his conference speech was probably the better ones out of the ones I've heard.
Oh, it was it was a very good conference speech. It was. Mm-hmm. I'm afraid it was a bit dull.
Give me a sense of this, because everyone at conference disagreed. I always think they're too long, all of them, not just his.
They're far too long.
Right?
Far too long. I hate conference speeches as a way.
I'm bored 15 minutes in.
Yeah, absolutely. I just yearn for the day when you get a uh, a party leader who gets up and gives a 5-minute speech.
Yeah, I mean, I wasn't in the actual room itself. I was at the back, which tells you how relevant I am these days. But within like 15 minutes, I was putting myself in the space of, listen, if I'm not a Labour voter or a Conservative voter,
yeah,
and I'm just watching on, I think I've changed the channel 10 minutes in, not because of what they're doing is bad, but it's just too long.
It was just, and it wasn't interesting enough. Mm. I mean, he didn't have an argument. I mean, the thing about Tony Blair is he always had an argument, and he was trying to persuade a reluctant party of what he believed and why he believed it, why they had to accept it, and they didn't like it, but they knew they would have to agree to it, and that was so. There was a drama and a tension, and he was just
a gifted orator as well.
In a league of his own. But I mean, actually, you know, Rishi Sunak's not a Tony Blair either, but and his speech was far too long as well. But I do remember listening to his speech all the way through. I mean, and it held my attention because he was actually arguing, he was making a case, he was explaining why HS2 was a bad investment and why he was going to cancel it. And I thought it was interesting. I thought it was persuasive. I actually agreed with that bit. And he was explaining why he wanted to stop young people ever taking up smoking and all that. You know, I mean, I thought, you know, whereas Keir Starmer was much more sort of general waffle and rhetoric and just sort of motherhood and apple pie, really.
Motherhood and apple pie, I like that. John, before I let you go, last one. Two quick predictions from yourself. If Labour win tonight, when's the next general election?
Well, I do wonder about January 2025. I think, in a way, Rishi Sunak will want to overtake Boris Johnson as Prime Minister. And I think to do that, he has to get as far as December, at least. So I think it'll either be October or December next year.
And if Labour lose tonight, when do you think it'll be? Does that change?
Well, it depends why they lose, and it depends what the swing is, and it depends which you know. If they fail to win Tamworth, then that means they've got a much lower swing than they got in Selby. And that, you know, I think you could turn, I mean, the Conservatives could turn that around into a story about how they're coming back, how they're advancing against Labour. Mid Bedfordshire, I think, tells us absolutely nothing, because that just depends on how the votes split between Labour and the Lib Dems. It's just gonna depend on a statistical sort of random chance.
Right. Thank you so much. That's Chief Political Commentator at The Independent, John Rentall, whose article has sparked our discussion today. John, thanks so much. I hope to have you on next year, and we'll see what happens. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
To John. So we've been talking, and I think John quite clearly put about his view as to why he thinks there will be a general election in 2025 if Labour are successful today. But I think one of the things that I'm taking away from today, I mean, I walked into the studio today thinking fairly confidently that there was going to be a general election in May 2024. I'm a lot less confident of that now that I've heard from Tim and I've heard from John. And I guess that's part of a good politics show, is my mind has been not changed, but influenced, I think. And so I think it's something to keep an eye on. And tonight we will know. You might be listening to this as the results have already come out. So you will have a better sense if you're listening to this on demand as to what's happened. And if the Liberal Democrats have won, you might already know what the stunt is, which has been the conversation in our studio as to, you know, is it going to be a brick wall they're going to break through? Is it going to be a door they smash? Is it going to be some hay? Who knows? But if they're successful, I guarantee you they've got a stunt in their back pocket. And so you'll know better than us. But I think it is a conversation that's going to continue to grow over the next couple of weeks. I want to go to the Vox Pop this week. As you know, it's one of my favorite parts of the show. It doesn't actually have to do with anything to do with elections this week. As you will have seen, Justice Secretary Alex Chalk has announced that prison sentences under a year will be scrapped for most criminals. And I wanted to know whether you agree with that policy or not. So our wonderful producers went out into central London to find out what people think of this policy.
It kind of depends on the crime, I think. But as long as they're set up to do something to make it better, do better for themselves... like community service, like, could potentially be better, but I do think it depends on the crime, really.
I think it depends on what the sentence is for. If it's something that's a violent crime, then no, should be in prison. But maybe for lesser crimes?
Yeah, I think if as long as there's some form of restriction there and there's a good system that's monitored, I don't see why it would be an issue.
I feel like if you've done something bad enough to go to prison, you shouldn't just get away with community service, you should go to prison.
I think it makes sense. I think if you're being sentenced to something for under a year, it's going to be such a minimal crime. I think prisons also affect your life in the longevity. So if you are having community service, I think there's a higher likelihood you'll be able to become back, re-established into the community. So I think it's totally the right way to go.
There you go. Pretty much overwhelming support for the policy, bar one. I want to thank everybody for being on the show today. Tim Bale, Professor of Politics at Queen Mary University, Councillor Nabila Maulana, Labour Councillor in Sheffield and Chair of Young Labour, and John Rentall, Chief Political Commentator at The Independent, whose article has sparked the discussions. You can catch us on all the good socials, TikTok, Instagram and Twitter at PoliticsFubar. I will join you next week. You can listen back on all of our programmes online. Salams.